The Duke of Blackwood, Alistair St. John, considered the document before him not as a marriage contract, but as the final clause in a long and tedious piece of estate business. For 5 years, he had managed the duchy with the same dispassionate efficiency he applied to his investments, his stables, and his infrequent social obligations. Now, the matter of an heir could no longer be postponed. It was a duty, and like all duties, it required a logical, unsentimental solution. His solicitor, a man whose face seemed permanently etched with the dry dust of legal archives, cleared his throat. "The final settlement on the Vance estate is generous, Your Grace. Baron Vance is relieved." Alistair dipped his pen in the inkwell, the scratch of the nib the only sound in the cavernous study. "It is not generosity, Finch. It is a transaction. He provides a daughter of suitable lineage and temperament. I provide the funds to keep his ancestral home from crumbling into the Northumberland soil. It is balanced." "And Miss Ilara Vance?" Finch ventured, his gaze flickering towards the Duke. "You have met her. You find her suitable?" Alistair paused, his pen hovering. He had met her twice. She had been presented at a country ball, a quiet figure in a pale gray dress, lost between more vibrant, chattering debutantes. He had danced his requisite waltz with her, a silent, formal affair. She was of medium height, with tidy brown hair and eyes that were, he could not recall their color. They were simply eyes. She was not beautiful, which was her primary qualification. She was not ugly, which was a secondary but still necessary one. She was, in a word, unremarkable. Perfect. "She is precisely what is required," Alistair stated, signing his name with a flourish of sharp, decisive strokes. "She is sensible. Her father assures me she is possessed of a quiet nature and has no frivolous interests. There will be no drama, no demands for London seasons, no foolishness. She will provide an heir, manage the household, and remain unobtrusive. A pretty face solves nothing, Finch. It merely invites complications, jealousy, and vanity. Her plainness is a virtue." He folded the letter containing this very sentiment, a letter he would send to Finch later to formally confirm his reasoning, as was his habit with all major decisions. He liked his logic recorded, unimpeachable. He placed it with his private correspondence to be dispatched in the morning. Finch gave a small, almost imperceptible nod. He had served the old Duke, and now the new one. He understood that arguing with Alistair Street. John was like arguing with the tide. The man's mind was made up, and the world was expected to arrange itself accordingly. The wedding was a quiet affair, held at the Vance's small parish church. Ilara was composed, her responses spoken in a clear, low voice. She wore a simple cream gown, unadorned with the lace and pearls that usually accompanied such occasions. Alistair found her composure satisfactory. It confirmed his assessment. She understood this was a contract, a merging of duties. Their journey to Blackwood Manor, the ducal seat, was conducted in near silence. Alistair read a treatise on agricultural drainage, a subject that had vexed him for years. The Blackwood Marshes, a vast, boggy expanse on the western edge of his property, were a blight. They sickened his tenants, swallowed livestock, and produced nothing but reeds and foul air. 5 years he had consulted engineers and surveyors, and 5 years they had told him the project was too vast, too expensive, too impossible. He had filed their reports away, a monument to intractable problems. He glanced up once, catching Ilara's reflection in the carriage window. She was looking out at the rolling hills, her expression unreadable. She did not fidget. She did not attempt small talk. He felt a flicker of approval. She was, indeed, a sensible woman. Their arrival was met with the full staff of Blackwood Manor lined up in the great hall. Mrs. Gable, the housekeeper who had been there since his own childhood, watched with sharp, intelligent eyes as he made the introductions. "Mrs. Gable, this is the Duchess." It was a perfunctory statement, but Mrs. Gable curtsied deeply. "Welcome to Blackwood, Your Grace." Her eyes, however, were on Ilara, a searching, assessing gaze that missed nothing. Ilara inclined her head. "Thank you, Mrs. Gable. I look forward to working with you." Her voice was calm, but Alistair noted a precision in her words that he had not remarked upon before. Not just politeness, but a kind of formal declaration of purpose. He dismissed it. She was merely taking her new role seriously. Good. That evening, before dinner, Ilara was in the suite of rooms that had been prepared for her. They were opulent, decorated in the heavy, gilded style of his mother's era. As she was unpacking a small crate of her own belongings, mostly books, a footman delivered a stack of correspondence. On top was a letter addressed to Mr. Finch in London, but which had evidently been mixed in with the papers sent to the manor by mistake. The Duke's seal was unbroken. Assuming it was an instruction for her, perhaps regarding an allowance, she opened it. She read it once. Then she read it again. The words were cold, clear, and precise. A logical argument for her selection as a broodmare, chosen precisely because she is not a great beauty. A pretty face solves nothing. It merely invites complications. Her plainness is a virtue. The paper did not tremble in her hands. Her breath did not catch. The world did not swim before her eyes. Instead, a profound and terrible stillness settled over her. It was the stillness of a frozen lake, absolute and deep. She had known, of course, that this was not a love match. She was not a fool. She had entered the arrangement with eyes wide open, aware that she was a solution to her family's financial ruin and the Duke's dynastic needs. But this was different. This was not just a lack of sentiment. This was a clinical appraisal and a dismissal of her entire personhood beyond her function. Her very lack of appeal had been weighed and measured as her most significant asset. She stood there for a long time, the letter in her hand. The silence in the room was absolute. Then, with meticulous care, she folded the letter along its original creases. She did not tear it. She did not burn it. She slipped it back into its envelope and placed it inside a small, locked box where she kept her mother's jewelry. A door had closed inside her. It had not slammed shut in a fit of pique. It had been quietly, deliberately, and irrevocably locked. From this moment forward, she would be everything he had paid for. She would be the Duchess of Blackwood. She would be sensible, unobtrusive, and efficient. She would manage his home. She would give him his heir. And she would be utterly, completely, and perfectly absent. The first few months of their marriage passed in a state of cool, professional courtesy. Alistair was, if anything, pleased with his choice. The household accounts, which he had always found a disorderly nuisance, were now presented to him weekly in a ledger written in a fine, clear hand. The menus were balanced, the staff managed with quiet authority, and the manor ran with the silent precision of a well-oiled clock. Ilara was the ghost in this new machine. She was present at dinner, seated at the far end of the long, polished table. She spoke when spoken to, her answers concise and intelligent. But she never initiated a conversation. She never offered an opinion unless directly asked. she was there, and she was not there. Alistair found this efficient. He had his evenings to himself in his study, free from the chatter he had so dreaded. He could work, read, and think without interruption. He had purchased peace, and it was being delivered. Yet, small things began to intrude upon his satisfaction. Tiny, dissonant notes in the placid harmony of his life. He had been told she played the pianoforte. There was an exquisite instrument in the morning room, which had sat silent for years. One afternoon, as he was returning from a ride, he heard music drifting from the open window. It was a complex, melancholic piece by Chopin, played with a skill that was far beyond mere accomplishment. It was artistry. He stood frozen on the gravel path, listening, arrested by the unexpected beauty of it. He entered the house quietly and walked towards the morning room. The moment his footsteps sounded on the marble floor of the hall, the music stopped, abruptly. He entered the room to find Alara standing by the window, her hands clasped behind her back. The pianoforte was closed. "I heard music," he said, his voice sounding overloud in the sudden silence. "Did you?" she replied, her tone level. "The wind must be playing tricks with the old house." She did not meet his eye. She simply looked out at the garden, her face a polite, placid mask. He knew she was lying. He knew the music had come from her fingers. The denial was so blatant, so calm, that it was not a lie so much as a boundary. A wall he had not known was there. He felt a prickle of annoyance, but said nothing more. A week later, he came upon her in the library. It was his domain, a vast two-story room filled with the leather-bound collections of 10 generations of St. John's. She was not reading poetry or a novel, as he might have expected. She was seated at a large table, surrounded by maps. His maps. The geological surveys of the Blackwood Marshes. She had a pencil in her hand and was making notes on a separate sheet of paper, her brow furrowed in concentration. When she saw him, she did not startle. She simply placed her pencil down and began to neatly stack the maps. "An interest in cartography, Duchess?" he asked, a hint of irony in his voice. "I was merely curious about the estate's topography," she said, her voice smooth and devoid of inflection. "It is a large property. I wish to understand its layout." "The marshes are the least interesting part of it," he said dismissively. "A wasteland." She looked at him then, and for the first time, he registered the color of her eyes. They were hazel, a complex mix of green and gold, and they were holding his gaze with an unnerving intensity. "Wastelands are only wastelands because no one has found a use for them yet," she said. Then she gathered her notes and left the library, leaving him standing beside the table, a strange echo of her words ringing in the air. A declarative statement, a small, sharp stone of an idea dropped into the still pool of his certainty. He began to notice her absence more than her presence. The empty chair at breakfast, with a message passed through a footman that the Duchess was taking her meal in her rooms. The silence from the morning room, a silence that now felt pointed, deliberate. He noticed that the books she was reading, left sometimes on a side table, were not novels, but treatises on Dutch engineering, crop rotation, and soil chemistry. He found himself watching her across the dinner table, trying to reconcile the quiet, unobtrusive woman he had married with the one who played Chopin like a virtuoso and studied engineering texts in secret. It was like looking at a familiar painting and suddenly realizing there was another image hidden beneath the surface. One evening, Lord Harrington, a neighboring landowner with more money than sense, came to dine. He was a gossip and a fool, a man Alistair tolerated but did not respect. "Well, Blackwood," Harrington boomed halfway through the port, "must say you've done it. Got yourself a duchess. Not one of the London belles, eh? A practical choice. Sensible girl. Good breeding." Alistair felt a muscle tighten in his jaw. He glanced down the table at Ilara. She was looking at her plate, her expression perfectly serene, as if she hadn't heard a word. But he saw the faint whitening of her knuckles where her hand rested on the tablecloth. "Ilara is everything I could have wished for in a wife," Alistair said, his voice colder than he intended. Harrington, oblivious, chuckled. "Of course, of course. A pretty face is just trouble, ain't it? Distracts a man from his duties." "You always were the clever one." The words, so close to his own, landed in the center of the room like a physical blow. Alistair felt a flush of heat crawl up his neck. He looked at Ilara again. She showed no reaction at all. Her composure was absolute. It was magnificent, and it was terrifying. After Harrington had finally departed, Alistair remained in the dining room, staring at the empty chair at the other end of the table. Ilara had excused herself the moment the guest was gone. He thought about the stopped music. He thought about the engineering books. He thought about her comment on wastelands. He thought about the chilling echo of his own words coming from the mouth of a fool like Harrington. A pattern was beginning to emerge, its shape monstrous and undeniable. He had not married a simple, sensible woman. He had married a woman of profound depth and intelligence, a woman with a soul full of music and a mind full of purpose. And he had told her, in writing, that her only value to him was her plainness. The realization was not a flash of lightning. It was a slow, creeping dread, the dawning horror of a man who discovers he has been living in a house with a locked room he never knew existed. And he was the one who had turned the key. The next day, he sought out Mrs. Gable. He found her in the linen room, overseeing the mending of sheets. "The Duchess," he began, feeling strangely clumsy. "She seems occupied." Mrs. Gable did not look up from her work. "Her Grace is a remarkable woman, Your Grace. The household has never been more orderly. She has a mind for systems. Sees how all the parts fit together." "Yes, I've seen the ledgers," he said impatiently. "But what does she do? Her days?" "Mrs." Gable finally lifted her head, her gaze direct. "She reads, Your Grace. She walks. She has been out on the edge of the marshes several times, speaking with the tenant farmers, the ones from Fen End, the ones whose children are always sick with the lung fever." The words landed. The tenants of Fen End. He paid them a stipend for their hardship, another line item in his ledgers. He had never spoken to them himself. "And she has been drawing," Mrs. Gable added, her voice softening slightly. "Maps, plans. She says the water has a memory, that if you watch it long enough, it will tell you where it wants to go." "The water has a memory." It was a poet's phrase, but she was using it to solve an engineering problem. A cold certainty washed over Alistair. He left the linen room and went directly to his study. He began to search through his files, his hands moving with frantic energy. He found the copy of the letter he had dictated to his secretary, the one intended for Finch. He read his own words, and for the first time, he understood their brutal weight. Her plainness is a virtue. He felt a wave of self-disgust so profound it almost buckled his knees. He had been so proud of his logic, his detachment, his freedom from sentiment. He saw now that it was not logic. It was a profound and arrogant blindness. He had looked at a diamond and seen only a useful piece of carbon, but he needed proof, proof that she knew. He went to her rooms. It was the first time he had entered her personal sitting room without being invited. It was tidy, impersonal, save for one corner. There, by the window, was a small desk. On it were stacks of paper covered in calculations and drawings. Cross-sections of the marshland, gradients, flow channels. It was a comprehensive proposal for a drainage system, more detailed and insightful than anything his expensive London engineers had produced. She had identified a series of natural ridges that could be used to create a gravity-fed canal system, a solution so elegant and obvious he could not believe no one had seen it before. She had solved the Blackwood Marshes. The problem he had shelved for 5 years, the problem that represented failure and frustration, she had quietly, methodically dismantled on her own. And then he saw it. On a small side table, a little rosewood box. It was unlocked. He opened it. Inside, nestled amongst a few pieces of simple jewelry, was a letter. His letter, folded and refolded so many times the creases were soft as cloth. He sank into the nearest chair, the letter in his hand, the enormity of his folly crashing down upon him. He had not just insulted her. He had not just misjudged her. He had committed an act of profound spiritual vandalism. He had taken a brilliant, vibrant soul and willfully ignored it, praised it for its lack of color, and driven it into a silent, secret exile within his own home. He was not a husband. He was a jailer. And the worst part was, his prisoner had never rattled the bars. She had simply built a new, richer world within their confines, a world to which he had no access. He sat there for an hour, perhaps longer, the silence of the room pressing in on him. He had to fix it. But how did one apologize for a crime of perception? How did one atone for the sin of not seeing? He knew words would not be enough. His entire marriage was founded on the lie that words on paper were the ultimate reality. He had to act. He found her in the one place on the estate that seemed to mirror her state, the old, neglected glass house. It stood at the far end of the walled garden, its panes clouded with grime, its iron frame weeping rust. Inside, most of the planting beds were barren, but in one corner, a small section had been cleared. Alara was on her knees, her skirts smudged with dirt, carefully tending a collection of small, fragile-looking seedlings. She looked up as he entered, her expression wary, but not surprised. She did not rise. He did not approach her immediately. He stood in the doorway, taking in the scene. The decaying grandeur of the structure, the determined patch of new life she was coaxing from the dirt. It was a perfect metaphor. "I found the letter," he said. His voice was raw. "The one I wrote to Finch. I found it in your room." She placed her small trowel down on the earth and finally rose, brushing the soil from her hands. She did not speak. She simply waited. "I also found your plans," he continued, his voice low, "for the marshes." A flicker of something, alarm, anger, crossed her face before being suppressed. "They are a private diversion, a mental exercise." "They are brilliant," he said, the word sounding inadequate. "They are the solution, the one I and all my paid experts failed to see for 5 years. He took a step closer. "I came here to apologize, but the word is meaningless. It doesn't begin to cover the truth of it." He stopped a few feet from her. "The truth is, I was a fool. A blind, arrogant, colossal fool. I wrote those words. I believed them. I believed that by stripping sentiment from the equation, I was being logical. I see now that I was simply being ignorant. I looked at you, and I did not see you. At all." He held her gaze, forcing himself not to look away. "I was wrong," he said, and the simple phrase carried the weight of his entire dawning epiphany. "I was wrong about you. I was wrong about what a marriage should be. I was wrong about everything that mattered." Alara watched him, her hazel eyes searching his face. The polite mask was gone. In its place was a profound, weary sadness. "And what is it you believe you see now, Your Grace?" she asked, her voice quiet but edged with steel. "I see a woman who plays Chopin with the soul of a master," he said, his own voice thick with emotion. "I see a mind that can solve a puzzle that has defeated engineers for a generation. I see a strength and a dignity that I have never encountered in anyone. I see the woman I married, and I am ashamed that it has taken me this long to do so." He gestured around the glasshouse. "You are bringing this place back to life. I seem to have done the opposite to you." For the first time since he had known her, he saw a glimmer of moisture in her eyes, but she did not weep. "You did not break me," she said softly. "You simply clarified the terms of my existence here. I resolved to be the Duchess you paid for, efficient, unobtrusive, and to keep the rest of me for myself." "I don't want that Duchess anymore," he said, his voice pleading. "I want the woman who understands that water has a memory. I want the woman who sees a use for wastelands. I want Alara." It was the first time he had used her given name without a title attached. It sounded foreign and intimate in the dusty air. She looked away from him then, towards her small patch of green. "Words are easy, Alistair. You are a man who values ledgers and contracts. What are your new terms?" The question was a challenge, a demand for proof, not poetry. He understood. He had built this transactional world. He would have to be the one to dismantle it, piece by painful piece. "First," he said, his mind racing, finding a new kind of clarity. "Tomorrow morning, I am dismissing the firm of Sterling and Sons. I am formally engaging you as the chief consultant for the Blackwood Marshes drainage project. You will have full authority and unlimited budget, and you will be credited, publicly, for its design." Her head snapped back towards him, her eyes wide with shock. "Second," he continued, pressing his advantage, "the pianoforte in the morning room will be tuned, and I will expect to hear it played, not by the wind." He paused, seeing the conflict in her face. He was offering her the one thing he had denied her: recognition, agency. "And third," he said, his voice dropping, "I will dine with you tonight, not at opposite ends of a 30-foot table. We will dine at the small table in the breakfast room. And you will tell me about your plans, not as a duchess reporting to a duke, as an engineer speaking to a layman who desperately needs to learn." He had laid his new terms on the table. They were not terms of love, not yet. They were terms of respect, a new contract to supersede the old one. Alara was silent for a long moment, her gaze fixed on the tiny green shoots at her feet. He could see the struggle within her. The quiet, safe world she had built for herself was being threatened, not by insult, but by invitation. To accept was to risk being hurt again. To refuse was to remain in her gilded cage. Finally, she gave a single, sharp nod. "The soil in this corner requires a specific potash mixture," she said, her voice not quite steady. "I will need to order it from London." "It will be an expense." It was not the answer he expected, but he understood it perfectly. She was testing him, starting with the smallest of terms. "Then you shall have it," he said, a surge of hope fierce and unfamiliar, rising in his chest. Whatever you need, for this garden, for the marshes, for anything. It was not a resolution, it was a beginning, the first crack in the ice of the frozen lake. That evening, they dined in the breakfast room. The vast, echoing silence of the main dining hall was replaced by an intimacy that was both awkward and charged with potential. Alistair found himself absurdly nervous. He had commanded men in boardrooms and faced down politicians, but he had no idea how to talk to his own wife. He started with the only thing he knew. "Tell me about the ridges," he said. "The ones you identified on the maps. My surveyors missed them entirely." Ilara hesitated for a moment, then began to speak. As she explained the complex interplay of geology and hydrology, a transformation occurred. The reserved, placid Duchess disappeared, and in her place was a passionate, articulate expert. She used her fork to draw diagrams on the tablecloth, her eyes alight with intellectual fire. She spoke of gradients and sluice gates, of the migratory patterns of birds that hinted at subterranean water flows, of the specific types of reeds that indicated soil salinity. Alistair listened, utterly captivated. He was not just hearing a plan, he was witnessing a mind at work, a mind he had so casually dismissed as sensible. He had been living next to a furnace, warming himself by its distant, residual heat, without ever realizing the inferno that burned within. The next morning, as promised, he sent a rider to London with a letter dismissing Stirling and Sons. He sent another with a formal letter addressed to the Duchess of Blackwood, chief consultant, retaining her services and granting her full authority over the Marsh project. He had Finch draw up a contract, complete with a handsome salary, which he deposited into a bank account opened in her name alone. It was a public act, and the gossip it generated throughout the county was immediate and intense. He did not care. He was tearing down the old structure and building a new one, and he wanted the world to see it. The project began. Ilara worked with a tireless, focused energy that astonished him. She was on site from dawn until dusk, speaking with laborers, directing surveyors, making adjustments to her plans. Alistair accompanied her, not as a duke overseeing his estate, but as an apprentice. He learned to read the land, to understand the language of water and stone. He learned the names of the tenant farmers from Fen End, listened to their stories, and saw the hope dawning in their eyes. In the evenings, they would work together in the library, surrounded by maps and charts. Their conversations were about the project, but beneath the technical jargon, a different kind of communication was taking place. He was learning her. He learned that her quietness was not timidity, but concentration. He learned that her wit was dry and sharp, and she would deploy it unexpectedly, leaving him momentarily speechless before breaking into a rare, genuine smile. He started noticing small things, details he had been blind to before, the way she chewed on the end of her pencil when deep in thought, the specific shade of gold that appeared in her eyes when the afternoon sun hit them, the fact that she preferred tea from Assam over Darjeeling. One afternoon, he returned to the house to the sound of the pianoforte. It was Bach this time, a fugue, intricate and mathematical and beautiful. He stopped in the hall, his heart clenching. He did not move forward. He simply stood and listened, allowing the music to fill the space he had so long filled with silence. When it finished, he walked away without letting her know he had been there. It was her space, her music. He would not intrude until invited. The invitation came a month later. He entered the morning room to find her sitting at the instrument, her hands resting on the keys. She did not stop or look away. "I am trying to recall a piece my mother used to play," she said, her voice soft. "I can only remember a fragment." She played a few bars, a simple, haunting melody. "Sit with me," she said. It was not a request. It was a quiet statement of fact. He sat beside her on the bench. The proximity was startling. He could feel the warmth from her arm, smell the faint scent of soap and the clean, earthy smell of the marshes that always clung to her now. "I don't know it," he said, his voice hoarse. "No," she said. "I wouldn't expect you to." She looked at him, her gaze clear and direct. "But you are listening. That is new." The rebuilding was a slow, deliberate process. It was built not on grand gestures, but on 1,000 small acts of attention. He brought her a rare book on Roman aqueducts he had sourced from a bookseller in Paris. She left a freshly cut flower from her burgeoning glasshouse on his desk. He learned to anticipate her needs on the worksite, having hot tea brought out when the wind turned cold. She began to seek his opinion, not on engineering, but on the social aspects of the project, how best to relocate a tenant, or how to structure the new land leases. They became partners. The power dynamic, once so starkly defined, had dissolved. They were two people working towards a common goal. The marsh, which had been a symbol of his failure, was becoming the foundation of their union. The external conflict came to a head at a large dinner party they hosted to celebrate the project's halfway point. Lord Harrington, ever the fool, cornered Alistair by the fireplace. "I say, Blackwood, the whole county is talking," he said, his voice conspiratorial. "Letting your wife play at being an engineer. A bit eccentric, even for you. Still, I suppose it keeps her busy. Better than her running up bills at the modiste, eh?" Before, Alistair would have met such a comment with a cold stare or a cutting remark. Now, he felt a different kind of anger, a protective, white-hot rage. But as he opened his mouth to speak, Alara's voice cut through the air, calm and clear. "Lord Harrington," she said, stepping to Alistair's side. "It is kind of you to take such an interest. In fact, I was just explaining to the Earl of March how we have increased the projected land yield by 12% by redesigning the main culvert. Perhaps you would be interested in the fluid dynamics." She looked at him with a bright, challenging smile, her hazel eyes glinting. Harrington, completely out of his depth, stammered something about needing to find his wife and beat a hasty retreat. Alistair turned to Alara, a slow smile spreading across his face. "Fluid dynamics?" "He is a man of limited depth," she said, the corner of her mouth twitching. "I thought it best to speak a language he would be certain not to understand." He laughed, a real, unburdened laugh. He reached out and, in full view of the crowded room, took her hand. She did not pull away. Her fingers curled around his, a quiet act of alliance. A year passed. The Blackwood marshes were gone. In their place lay miles of fertile, dark earth, crisscrossed by neat canals that gleamed in the sun. Cottages were being built, fields were being plowed, and the air was clean. The project was a triumph, and the Duchess of Blackwood was hailed as a genius. But the true transformation had happened within the walls of the manor. The house was no longer just orderly, it was alive. Music was a common sound. Laughter could be heard in the corridors. The great dining table was now used only for formal occasions. Most nights, Alistair and Alara ate together in the breakfast room or in the library, their conversation ranging from politics to poetry to the proper fertilization of roses. Alistair stood in the doorway of the morning room, watching his wife. She was seated not at the pianoforte, but in a comfortable chair by the window, a book in her lap. She was no longer a quiet, overlooked figure in gray. She wore a dress the color of moss, and her hair was arranged in a slightly softer style. She was not, by the glittering standards of London society, a great beauty. He knew that. But the word plain was a blasphemy. Her face was the most interesting, most expressive, most beloved landscape he had ever known. It was a map of intelligence, resilience, and a quiet, powerful grace. She looked up as if sensing his presence and smiled. It was a full, open smile that reached her eyes, crinkling the corners. "You are staring," she said. "I am admiring," he corrected, walking into the room. He knelt by her chair and took her hand. "I was just thinking. A year ago, this room was silent." "A year ago," she replied, her fingers tightening on his. "I had a different understanding of my position here." He brought her hand to his lips. "I have a new contract for you to consider." She raised an eyebrow. "Oh? And what are the terms of this one?" "Lifelong," he said, his voice soft. "Exclusive. The clauses include shared laughter, continued debate on all subjects, the occasional playing of Chopin, and the raising of the air that is, I am told, on the way." Her eyes widened slightly, and a soft blush colored her cheeks. She was newly pregnant, a fact they had only just confirmed. "It is a demanding contract," she said, her voice teasing. "What does the other party offer in return?" "Everything," he said simply. "My respect, my attention, my name, my heart, everything I have and everything I am. It is all yours. It has been for a long time." He was no longer the Duke of Blackwood making a transaction. He was a man, humbled and hopeful, confessing his love. Ilara's smile softened into something breathtakingly tender. She reached out and touched his cheek. "In that case, Your Grace," she whispered, leaning in to kiss him, "I accept your terms." He had once written that a pretty face solves nothing. He had been wrong, but he had been right about one thing. A face did not solve his problem. A mind did. A soul did. A woman whom he had been too blind to see had solved the one problem he had avoided for 5 years, and in doing so, had solved the even greater problem of his own empty, logical heart. He had looked for an unobtrusive duchess and found, by sheer, undeserved grace, the architect of his entire world.